Texas Talking. What was that you said? Texas Talking. Gonna hoop upside your head. Texas Talking. Tell me, who can you trust when Texas gods are Texas gods love?
Hey, y'all. Welcome to the Tribcast. This is Ryan Sitton, Republican candidate for Railroad Commissioner. Double R and Double E are about to dish on R&Ds. It's Ramsey, Reeve, Emily, and Evan. And now, here's your host, Reeve the Hammer Hamilton.
Thank you for that enthusiastic introduction.
What the hell was that?
That was the best introduction yet.
This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the final week of June. Joining me is Editor-in-Chief and CEO Evan Smith.
I'm just going to say that Ryan Sitton was inhaling methane gas or something. I don't know
that
what.
Would have been funnier with helium.
Chemically induced that intro. God.
You just heard executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And then we also have editor Emily Ramshaw.
You know, my dad's nickname was The Rammer, which made me think of that when he called you The Hammer.
I don't know that anybody has ever called you The Hammer.
No. No, it's not on my top 10 list of nicknames.
Of nicknames?
Oh, well, that I've now gotten. We're going to do the top 10 list of Reeve's nicknames.
One of them, is Reeven Hamilton, like Dave and Buster's.
No, Reeven, that's right.
Who called you that?
That actually went out on a Tribune email.
Did it?
Yeah, it was a typo. Let's not dwell on this issue. We have many topics to cover, including. I guess this
have you already forgotten
today's landmark anniversary?
Yeah, this is the very backward
of the Voting Rights Act that anniversary.
No, we're not going to pay any attention to that. Actually,
yeah, right?
Yeah.
No, let's do the anniversary of the filibuster. Emily, can you remind us what the filibuster was?
Sure. A year ago today, if you may have forgotten, Wendy Davis stood in those pink running shoes for debatably between 10 and 13 hours.
Definitely not debatable that's between those.
For some period of time. For
11 hours, I think, was the final number.
It is remarkable that people can't seem to agree on what the actual.
Well, you know, it all got complicated by the time that people were, you know, trying to drop the hammer and kick her off of there.
Excuse me. I'm right here.
Right. Sorry. Wrong
leave
hammer.
Reeve out of this.
Right.
Drop your mind on his head.
Does that count the time that Rodney Ellis was adjusting her back brace?
Right. That's all.
Well, does it count the post three strikes and you're out point of order, but the pre-David Dewhurst clock manipulation?
No one knows, and the actual duration is neither here nor there. She spoke for a very long time trying to defeat greater restrictions on abortion in Texas. The filibuster itself was more or less successful when the clock ran out and the Capitol erupted into chaos, although that abortion legislation did pass in a subsequent special session. So we had some interesting competing columns today on Trib Talk. That's sort of a look at, you know, whether this filibuster was successful or not. Did this day matter or did this day not matter? I know Ross has had some interesting takes on that.
Well, Ross actually said in his column in the Tribune today that I'm going to paraphrase this, but basically whether or not you liked the filibuster, it mattered.
Right? Yeah, it was a big deal. I mean,
do you agree with that, Ross?
I do. Yeah.
He said it.
Unusually, I do agree with something. You know, I often disagree with my column, but yeah, I mean, it was a big deal if you were a Republican or a Democrat, and everything – not everything, but a lot of what both those two political parties have been doing in the last year is one of them's trying to make it stick and turn, you know, that moment into a movement, and the other one is trying to make sure it just remains a moment, that it was, you know, it was that one time and it never happened again. The Republicans would rather move along from there and say, you know, that was a moment of bad behavior and bad government, and we corrected it in a special session the next day. Nothing to see here. Folks, go home. The Democrats are looking at it and saying, you know, we had an unusual show of political strength that night, and in the same ways that some of the Republicans capitalized on the populist Tea Party, they're trying to capitalize on this populist movement, all the people in orange shirts that night.
Why can't they both be right? I think they're both right.
Well,
I think
sort of the question is, yeah. Is – it mattered past tense versus it matters present tense.
Or what makes a movement? Like what determines it? Literally, how have they moved? So have they begun voting in bigger numbers because of this filibuster? There was no evidence of that in the primary.
You know, their primary was a, you know, it's you're right. It wasn't a very good test because most of their primaries were not contested. Mm-hmm. People didn't, you know, there were some minor candidates in some of those. In fact, Wendy Davis had one of those. Ray Madrigal ran against Wendy Davis and got
79%.
Got 29%. She got 79%.
Yeah, she got 79%.
And
very easy to get them confused.
She won.
Well, she got 79.
But there weren't the kind of primaries that the Republicans had that drew a lot of interest, you know, like the lieutenant governor's race and the AG's race and those kinds of things. So they're not going to draw a crowd for those.
Those uncontested candidates were largely determined by the filibuster. Wendy Davis and Letitia Vanderpute played their big roles in that evening, and sort of that is why they are the candidates they are today.
And in that respect, the filibuster most assuredly mattered. I think the idea that somehow that was just any night is crazy. You cannot be honest about the modern political history of Texas and believe that that night was just another night up the street.
Right. It played a role clearly in establishing the people who were going to run for office. Did it play a role in the state's abortion legislation?
No.
The,
you know, would Larry Wright have his HBO show about the Texas legislature?
I don't think he would.
I do think he would. I don't think that the Larry Wright – I know that a number of people have said that the Larry Wright thing is entirely because of the Wendy Davis thing. It isn't. I've talked to Larry about it. I don't believe it actually is about that. I think it's more about the world of Texas politics, which preceded the filibuster and has succeeded the filibuster. Texas politics has been much more over this last year than the aftermath of the filibuster. To Emily's point about did abortion legislation materially change as a result of it? No. And I suspect that Wendy Davis would say, if she's honest, we didn't expect to win the war. We were just trying to win the battle. And the battle was largely symbolic because we knew that what would happen next was that the governor would call a second special and they didn't have the ability to run the clock out, and that was it. But again, the Democratic Party for the last 20 years has effectively put up as candidates, not in every case, but in the majority of cases, department store mannequins and cardboard cutouts. In this election cycle, they have real candidates, at least in the top two slots. That is a direct byproduct of that night.
But Democrats have been saying for years that their person is not a cardboard cutout.
This is Lucy in the football.
Come on.
Well, come on. Carlos Sanchez. I mean, Tony Sanchez.
We like Tony Carlos Sanchez.
I like Carlos just fine. I'm not sure that he's running for anything.
Carlos ought to run, I think.
Too many Sanchez.
Ahead of Asney, but I don't think.
Maybe. Bill White. I mean, those people were, you know, maybe Farouk Shami.
With no disrespect to either Tony Sanchez or Bill White, Neither one is as consequential. Neither one is as consequential a figure as Davis was as a direct result of that filibuster. Well, Wendy Davis is a national and international celebrity. In some respects, she has an Ann Richards problem. This was said of Governor Richards in the late days of her term as governor, that she's more popular outside of Texas than in. Davis is more of a celebrity and therefore probably has the ability to get more people to her, right? Outside than inside, at least as of the numbers right now. But there's no question that the filibuster propelled her and Vanderpute both forward.
What about the point that Senator Campbell made in her Trip Talk column about how, you know, the topic that Davis discussed during her filibuster is rarely mentioned on the campaign trail?
It's a double edge. That's one of the interesting things about this race has been that, live by the thing that made you a celebrity, die by the thing that made you a celebrity. For every person that the abortion issue sort of said flatly attracts, it also brings somebody else over who opposes it, and therefore you. It's not like it's a motherhood issue or an apple pie issue that's kind of generally heralded and embraced, where just by virtue of being associated with it, everybody is for you. It's a double edge.
You know, they're having this big event tonight, Wednesday night, that's sort of a rally commemorating the anniversary of the filibuster. Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood nationally, will be there. Letizia Vanderpute, Wendy Davis, the whole sort of lineup of people who are there on filibuster night. You know, I can only assume that abortion is going to be front and center in this, although they haven't really made it front and center of the campaign to this point.
The way it shows up on the campaign trail is people talking about House Bill 2, which is a little bit of a euphemism for that bill, which did further regulate abortions and also raise the standards for women's health clinics that provide abortions in a way that puts some of them out of business. I think the lasting impact of this, if there is one, is going to be, or the question about it is going to be, did this engage people who were not otherwise engaged in politics, and did it engage them in a way that benefits the moribund Texas Democratic Party? Mm-hmm. And you'll see, you know, you might see a little bit of that in the November elections. You might see a tail. You know, I think there's going to be a story to be told one way or the other, kind of November 6th, 7th, and 8th after the election. What do the Democrats do? What do they – do they actually have a sustaining effort to organize going forward after that? Or is this just this year's – oh, really this time?
Will you be able to gauge what that might look like from the Democratic convention this coming weekend?
Some. I mean, you're going to see – you know, you're either going to see some –
it's a pep rally every time.
Yeah, but you're going to see some new faces or not. You're going to see some people talking about, you know, are they really debating issues here, or is it the same old groups sort of fighting over a diminishing, you know, pie like the Democrats have been?
Look, on election night in November, Wendy Davis is either going to exceed Bill White's vote total 4 years ago or she's not. And either way, it will be news. If she does better than Bill White, Democrats will claim.
Better be news.
Well, but the Democrats will claim it's going to be news
either
way.
That's what we do for a living.
But not for our purposes.
Got to write something. Yeah.
Democrats, if she exceeds Bill White's vote total, Democrats will claim progress made. If she doesn't, then it'll be fair to – well, she finished with fewer votes in the Democratic primary than he did. It'll be few. It will be said that somehow, despite having the first genuine Democratic celebrity in 20 years, they couldn't make anything happen. The fact is, we're having a conversation about both the governor's and a lieutenant governor's race, at least having the veneer of being competitive because of that night. Had that filibuster not happened, she would not be running for governor in all likelihood.
They didn't have candidates the week before the filibuster.
Right.
They
That's
were
the
scouting around, you know, looking in the couch for
She would not be in all likelihood running for governor. She'd be running for her own Senate district, let's just assume. Senator Van de Putte would presumably not be running either. The Democrats would have put up a nominal field, a pulse and a heartbeat.
So
like
fair to
a
say,
a cardboard cutout or a mannequin?
Well, yes.
Neither of which have a pulse or a heartbeat.
And those people, but those people who were up would be of a vastly different brand.
So moved the ball on politics, did not move the ball on policy.
Well, it's impossible to move the ball on policy until you move the ball on politics, because right now the people who are in charge are people who don't want to see the ball moved on policy.
Or politics.
Right? You need new people to move the ball on policy. Elections have consequences, the oldest cliche in the world. It happens to be true. If you don't elect people who are going to move the ball on policy, then policy is not going to move.
Well, just before we move on ourselves, anything else to be expected out of the Democratic convention?
No, I think that they're going to, you know, they've done a good job over the last few years. Garnet Coleman in the House has been running the platform for about 10 years, and he's done a really good job of taking sharp objects off the table. The Republicans tend to go into their conventions and make really hard statements of policy, really, you know, you're either with us or against us kind of statements on policy.
Against the will of the chairman, apparently.
In a way that sometimes divides the Republicans themselves. The Democrats have been pretty careful to not do that. So I think that, you know, when I say that they're not going to make news, I think that they're not going to make news largely by design, and they're going to try to draw attention to their stars.
I mean, isn't it also largely that Democrats are less divided right now as a party than Republicans are?
If you're –
Republicans seem to have more to fight about.
Right. Well, you know, they're in charge. So it's sort of like, you know, it's the Evan Smith line that there's two parties in Texas and they're both Republicans. You know, they're fighting amongst themselves. The Democrats are not numerous enough to do that right now.
I am curious about one aspect of this, Reeve, and that is south of Van de Putte and Davis on the ballot. Are there any of the lesser known Democratic nominees for important offices, even though they're mid-ballot, who emerge – this will be the first time that a lot of people are going to get to see them.
What, like Sam Houston?
Sam Houston's going to be the one to watch, I think.
Sam Houston, Mike Collier, we've seen a little bit more of.
John Cook and his guitar.
John Cook, the candidate against George
Bush.
What's
his guitar right?
Jim Hogan.
He ran for mayor of El Paso, running around with a guitar singing folk songs.
I want to know if Farmer Hogan is going to leave Cleburne for the convention or not.
I doubt it.
And I'd be curious to see what he – look,
he doesn't need the attention.
He's all up in the World Cup right now.
And, you know, and then the one
– That was a shake of the head from Ross.
The one statewide African-American candidate among the major offices on the ballot is the Democratic candidate for Railroad Commission, Steve Brown,
right.
And I'd be curious to see how he does. I mean, the fact is, I think there's an opportunity. Conventions aren't important to the majority of voters or even to
humans,
journalists, anybody. But I do think it's an opportunity to see how they present in a setting like this. And I think that would be – I'm curious to see, again, because of Sam Houston's particular candidacy with the Paxton issues that are festering, and have the potential to create a problem for the Republicans – the Democrats need to have somebody who would inherit the benefits of that problem.
These are right? Ken Paxton, the Republican candidate for attorney general, has some violations of state securities law that have been dogging him. He won the primary despite those.
Yeah, he went. He Jay Root did a story on these. Our Jay Root, and then Paxton went in.
Our Jay Root.
Jay Root of. Liberty, Texas.
The golden voiced warbler, or whatever you call him.
Did some stories on Paxton advising estate clients in his legal practice to invest in a company without also telling them that he was getting an agency fee from that company if they made the investments. And so he paid some fines with the Texas Securities Board and straightened a lot of that up. But as Evan says, it's a running question, and he's got a. He's provided an opportunity if a Democrat is in position to take it.
Democrats want this to be Ken Ghazi, right, going forward. Well, but they can't do anything with it if they don't have anybody who can leverage the potential benefits of it.
You've been wanting to use that word since you thought of it in the shower this morning, right?
I've been using it for weeks.
But
it illustrates the problem that they have, which is that they don't really have much of anything to throw against him. And Sam Houston, this is his moment to show whether he can be a credible alternative.
Luckily, he has a recognizable name.
And Dan Branch couldn't do it. You know, Dan Branch had a bunch of money to advertise with and had this information and, you know, tried using it in the Republican primary and didn't in the runoff, rather.
And asked and answered,
Didn't get anywhere with it. So Paxton can walk away and say, the voters have already endorsed me again.
Yeah, he just kept his head down for 3 weeks and didn't say a word.
Right.
Well, in addition to being the anniversary of the filibuster, it's also the anniversary of the day that House Speaker Joe Strauss issued a proclamation that basically started the legislative investigation of UT Regent Wallace Hall.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
There was a lot going on that day.
So many anniversaries.
Quite a day.
Quite a day.
Well, everyone will always remember June 25th, I think, as long as Texas is around.
Wow.
Which hopefully is why.
Yeah. They'd already forgotten.
Yeah. The thing is, so that investigation of Hall is still going on for people that listen to this.
Yeah, it'll never end.
Podcast, they may know that, there's a committee mulling Hall's impeachment. They've voted that grounds for impeachment exist, and they're currently writing articles of impeachment that they are planning on discussing further sometime in July. We don't know exactly if they'll be able to agree on any, and we'll see how that goes. But sort of complicating this is, Hall has repeatedly raised allegations of sort of misconduct at the University of Texas at Austin. And one of those has finally gained some traction, which is this idea that there's sort of favoritism for those with political connections in UT
Applicants.
Austin's admissions.
And the idea would be that if I have a political connection, I can call my connection and say, hey, I can't get into UT law school. Can you get me in? And bada bing, bada
boom. Can you get my kid in? Right. Or can you write a letter
on
my
kid's
behalf?
Right.
And so the system at the end of last week on Friday, I was talking to Chancellor Francisco Sigueroa, and he had previously decided that they weren't going to launch a full investigation of these allegations because they had done an internal sort of review at the system. And something happened where he decided to change course, and they're going to have a big full vetting of the thing. They're going to hire an external investigator.
So did something happen, like you think he found some additional information and decided that this is worth a full-scale review? Because the internal initial review was that, yes, it did appear that these applicants got in at higher rates, but there wasn't really anything more to see here, and this was not like an institutional problem. And now suddenly we're having an institutional review?
Well, the first one was an institutional review. This is a,
external.
The difference between a review and an investigation is sort of a term of art because.
Well, presumably something happened. Emily's right. Presumably something happened between.
Well, you don't have to presume. I think Sigueroa said that this is because of ongoing questions that can't be answered by the limited nature of the first review and because he has received additional input, quote unquote.
What is that? Okay, well, what's that?
But his quote also says he wants this investigation so that they can sort of clear the air and end this, right?
I think they tried to clear the air the first time. And I think they did a review or investigation, whatever you want to call it, of the University of Texas at Austin by the University of Texas system and tried to call that a third-party review.
It's what they and, this, and people like looked, the Barry Bergdorf investigation.
This is a point that
people
we
looked
sort of
at it. Yeah, well, people looked at
yeah,
it and
Emily
said,
and
"You
I
can't."
Run it back and forth on
we
this.
Have, we
mean,
have a disagreement
you have
here.
To, you I have think, to appreciate in this situation that there is absolutely no love lost between anyone at the system and the university.
I don't I appreciate
still,
that. They've still
I
got the same. They've got the same logo.
I called it the fox guarding the hen house.
Right.
And then I think we transitioned this into it's like more like a mother investigating her kid.
And I said it was like your evil stepmother investigating your redheaded stepchild.
My question is, which mother and which kid?
I've investigated myself.
That girl right. she beat, who is it?
I've investigated myself and found myself innocent does not sell.
It's like
as
I've investigated my kid and found my kid innocent, well, which is almost said, worse.
Technically, they did not investigate themselves, but I grant you that the optics of it are not great.
Yeah.
I have another question entirely. There's a Casablanca thing going on here. We're shocked to discover powerful people writing letters on behalf of constituents.
Yeah, try writing a column on that. People well, think you endorse
but
it.
But here's my question. Here's my question.
I thought you had Wallace Hall saying, here's looking at you, kid.
Are you
going to
tell
Powers.
Me? of all the gin
the
joints in the world.
Yeah, we'll,
right?
always have, we'll always have law school.
I have a question. Are you going to tell me, Reed, that no
I'm not going to tell you anything.
No legislators have ever written letters on behalf of applicants to Texas A&M?
No, this
no.
happens
are you
everywhere.
Tell me that none have written letters on behalf of applicants to Tech? Where in the hell is the drumbeat to investigate those letters?
If I was at all inclined to talk to you, I would maybe tell you that had happened. So we've asked for letters from Texas A&M, and they have – I mean, they haven't given us any, but they've – there are clearly something they don't want to give us because they've appealed it to the Attorney General.
So somebody actually in Texas did want help getting into Texas
A&M. Stand by. I want this clear. You're telling me that we have asked for any letters written by legislators to the Texas A&M?
They went straight to the president or the chancellor, because that's
right.
the issue is that they go outside the prescribed process.
We have asked
process.
For any letters that went from legislators to the president or chancellor of A&M recommending applicants to various schools. Not in what?
A&M specifically.
A&M specific. But I mean within the A&M universe, because the issue at UT has been the law school principally, right?
It's been both.
It's been UT admissions generally.
And
too.
The response from the A&M system has been to ask the AG to keep us from getting access to those letters?
Yeah.
It's not public information. It's under FERPA, blah, blah, blah,
but
blah.
But also, this happens at every academic institution in the United States.
College,
I'm sure.
University, private school.
Heck yeah.
Now, but this has become an issue at in other
right,
schools.
Illinois.
So the most famous one is in Illinois in 2009. An investigation found that there was actually a separate category for applicants with political connections.
Why you'd want to go to Illinois over Northwestern is really anyone's guess anyway.
This happens in a lot of institutions, and I'm not excusing it at all, but there was a big story in the Dallas Morning News years ago. You may remember the date when it turned out that the University of Texas Medical System, Parkland Hospital, had a list of people that if they went into the emergency or they went into
got special treatment
into surgery, they had carte blanche treatment, white glove treatment, and this. Don't
Evan's
you know who
probably
this is,
on that
right?
list at Breckenridge.
Look, one difference may be that the University of Texas is a public institution.
Well,
you know, St. Mark's School of Texas, which is where Wallace Hall is an alumnus of St. Mark's.
He was on the board. Or was on the board.
I believe he may have been a student at St. Mark's. Let's just say for
let's
argument's
sake. Let's just say Rushmore,
he,
just for laughs.
Let's just say for argument's sake that he was. The difference between somebody writing a letter on behalf of an applicant to St. Mark's and someone writing a letter on behalf of an applicant to UT would be that UT is a public institution. Public dollars flow through that institution.
It's neither
somebody
here nor
writing
there.
A le- well, no, I think it is. It is. Because if – well, so let me
then say –
all right, let me ask it this way. Let's assume that an elected official was writing a letter on behalf of an applicant to Baylor Law School.
Mm-hmm.
Baylor's a private institution. Would we be as concerned about
I think so. I don't
Baylor
think there's
letter.
Any difference that it's a public university.
I think there is a difference.
It's a gender, and this is a gender split.
Well, no, the difference here is that a public institution is supposed to be equitable enough in allowing people in that everybody has a shot, and it's not supposed to be for an elite that happens to be politically connected. And if you're trying to get people into school, right. and every time somebody who's politically connected knocks somebody else out of a chair, you're
so
that
Senator,
much less equitable about getting into the
So Brian Birdwell writing a letter on behalf of a constituent in Waco or Granbury or what have you to Ken Starr or to the admissions office at Baylor is a different question, appropriateness,
right.
than, say, Joe Strauss or Judith Zaffarini or any of the others who have alleged to have written letters on behalf of people for UT.
Well, and
it's
even,
them wielding
it's
authority, often about kids they don't even know.
And it's not really writing letters. That's the tough thing about I mean, the question is not can these people write letters for people.
If it's a real deal, they just make a phone call, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. That part we don't even know.
No,
right.
But I mean, so far no one has really questioned the can people write recommendation letters for people they know. I mean, that seems to be perfectly fine. These are all the letters that they looked at in the first review are letters that went outside the standard admissions process. And actually, so Sigurova said that one of the changes they're going to say is that no letters that come in outside that process, either through the president's office or through a dean's office or something, will be considered in their reviews of applicants
going forward. My daughter applies, just to pick a hypothetical example, my daughter applies to UT, and a legislator writes a letter on her behalf, and it is one of her official recommendations as part of the applications process, and it goes through the admissions office. That's okay. From Sigurova's perspective.
Yeah, if it goes straight to the admissions office.
Front door, not side door.
But if it goes to Powers and then Powers sends it to the admissions office.
So front door, not side door.
If the kid gets into school on his or her merits, it doesn't matter who wrote a letter for them. If they wouldn't have got into school but for the letter from influential person A or B, then you got a problem.
Well, except.
Except for that's the purpose of those letters.
If the admissions office gets two applications, one contain, and the students are of equal merit or worthiness to be admitted, and one of them has recommendation letters from the science teacher at the school and from the neighbor whose lawn the kid mowed for years to show the kid's kind of hard work ethic and character. The other application has letters from the speaker and the chair of the higher ed committee in the Senate.
Hire the kid who mows lawns.
Admissions office gets both, and there's one spot. You're telling me that I actually think that it still matters. It seems to me that it still does matter. And the admissions office has to disregard the clout of the person who writes the recommendation letter.
Well, the universities are having to cut back on their janitorial and gardening services. So the lawnmower might actually
get in. But you understand the point. I'm not sure that it matters all that.
No, I think, the thing is influential people have influence no matter which door they enter through. I mean, is it undue influence or is it just influence is the question.
And I don't think, go ahead.
No, I was just going to, and the influence of it coming, the appearance of it coming through the president's office and having the president's, email traffic on it and having it forwarded from that level in administration, I think looks, like additional influence.
And the idea of somebody writing a recommendation letter to the president or anybody else with clout is not so much the issue, because let's say you've got somebody who wants to get into Vanderbilt.
Great school.
And you've got the speaker who is an alumnus of Vanderbilt writing a letter, but you then have somebody who is not politically – that's a bad example. UT. Let's make it a UT thing. So Senator Zaffarini is a UT alumnus. Senator Zaffarini writes a letter. But then you have a CEO of a – Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, writes a letter. He's another distinguished alumnus of UT. Is Rex Tillerson writing a letter to Bill Powers on behalf of an applicant okay? But Judith Zaffarini is not okay because somehow there's an appropriations aspect to a legislator.
No, the issue here is whether the system is fair. I mean, it's case by case, but does somebody have their thumb on the scale on behalf of somebody because of a call from an influential person?
So Rex Tillerson writing a letter is the same as Judith Zaffarini, both bad?
And let's just be clear. This debate is not about students with, high levels of merit necessarily getting it.
That's exactly right.
It's about students who apparently, have not been as qualified.
Students lower on the bubble.
Yeah.
So Rex Tillerson writing a letter on behalf of a kid who may not have the best grades or the best LSATs is a problem?
I'm not saying it's a problem. It's a problem if that tips the scales and that student gets in over other qualified, more
I think people would raise
questions
if because Rex Tillerson gives money to UT, he can control the admission system.
Well, then the attempt to investigate this is going to go back hundreds of years to the very origins of the higher ed system. I mean, again, this is a Casablanca thing. I'm shocked to discover that donors to universities have influence over shit that happens on university
campuses. But your history of doing bad things is not a defense against doing bad things in the future.
No, but it's as if this problem
– still do the TripCast anyway.
But it's as if – right. No, but it is as if – but there is a little bit of this like we just discovered that this problem
is –
That's why it sort of remains to be seen how it serves Hall – as he's investigated by other people, right? So like even if this plays out sort of validates some of his concerns, that doesn't necessarily scuttle his the investigation of him by the legislature, which, the people involved in that have said that they're investigating sort of more his means than his ends. And whether that's an excuse to just keep investigating or not, we'll see. But, the exact way this plays out, because in part because of what you said about the sort of everyone sort of knows this aspect of this scandal remains to be seen.
But tactically, you have to say from the Hull side, it's pretty brilliant to go after many of the people who would be for impeaching him, because the appearance now exists that they're impeaching Hull to shut down any investigation.
It gives him a forum. Mm-hmm.
It gives him a forum. I mean, you have to say tactically, it's pretty smart.
All right. Well, if you would like to say that to us in an email, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. We'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music and encourage everyone to go to iTunes and review us very positively. On behalf of Emily Ross, Evan,
say bad things about us, right? That's okay. We don't mind.
Also, Shiny Ribs is playing at Blues on the Green in Austin tonight. Oh, but the weather's bad.
Also, this podcast, well, most people listen to it not tonight.
Well, that's their problem.
Look at the analytics.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Our producer, Todd, did I say his name?
Todd.
Well, I did now. He's here, and we thank him.
We'll tweet out a picture of his shoes later. You wouldn't believe it.
They're like very art department chic.
He works at the art department, apparently. That's the issue.
All right. So long, everyone.
Texas talking about Texas talking, baby. Texas talking about it. Texas talking, baby.
Hey, Capizio Pumps, can we get started here? I've got to get moving.